So that will be our routine. I hope it will be useful, but we'll see. We'll take it as it comes. Now I've got the recorder back on. And we can begin with some substance. So let's see. We've got a half hour. Let me begin by telling you a little bit about who I am. You're going to be listening to me for the next 15 weeks. You should know a little bit about who this person who's going to be standing in front of you talking about American society, who this person really is. So I was born in 1947. That makes me 65 years old. At this time of the year, every September for the past 60 years, without fail, I've been in school. There hasn't been a September since I was 5 years old. And I suppose if you count preschool, goes back even a couple years longer. There has not been a single September where I haven't been in school. I was born in Berkeley, California. My father was on the GI Bill in medical school after World War II when I was born. I'm an early baby boomer. The baby boom officially starts, technically, it's anybody who was conceived after the end of World War II. So the first year of baby boomers is early 1946. Right, so that's the kind of technical definition of a boomer. I'm a 1947 baby, so I was born after World War II. My dad was in medical school at the University of California. He had previously before World War II, he had gotten a PhD in psychology, as did my mother, at the University of Iowa. And during the war, my dad was in the Navy as a psychologist, and then went back to school to get a medical degree so he could be a psychiatrist. When I was four, we moved to Lawrence, Kansas, where my parents were professors at the University of Kansas. My mom's still alive. She now lives in Madison. She was a professor of rehabilitation psychology, quite well known in her field, and lives now in Madison close by. I grew up in Lawrence, Kansas, in an extremely academic household. Both of my siblings became professors, and both of them married professors. So I knew from about age 10 that I wanted to be a professor. I didn't know exactly what kind. That came later. But I knew from as long as I can remember that I wanted to be an academic of some sort or other. The joke in the family is that the only social mobility is interdepartmental. So I'm just pursuing the family business, as it were. I have two daughters, neither of whom are academics, so the family business doesn't continue indefinitely. So I grew up in Kansas. In my senior year in high school, I was planning to go to the University of Kansas, where all my friends were going, but a friend of my parents gave me as a Christmas present an application to Harvard. And this is a true story. It's the only place I applied to. I was already admitted into KU. As a high school senior, I had taken some classes at University of Kansas. That's where I expected to go, but I sent in the application and got admitted. So instead of going to KU, I went to Harvard instead. And who knows how important that was in terms of my subsequent career and intellectual development, but it certainly was for me as a 17-year-old in 1964, going off to Harvard was a big adventure. After Harvard, I got a scholarship to study at Oxford, which I did for 2 years, and did a second undergraduate degree. So I have two undergraduate degrees. I did a kind of social science interdisciplinary degree at Harvard and then studied history at Oxford. When I was done at Oxford, I faced a problem, which was the Vietnam War. I was healthy, so I wouldn't get a medical deferment, and I lived in Kansas. That was where my draft board was, and Kansas was one of the places where it was extremely hard to get a conscientious objector status. That is, I opposed the Vietnam War. I thought it was an unjust war. It was an offensive war, not a war that was in defense of our national security. It was an offensive and illegitimate war. And there was no way that I was going to serve in the military in what I felt to be an immoral military action. But I couldn't get conscientious objector status in Kansas because it was impossible unless you had a lifelong membership in a religious community that was pacifist. And I wasn't really pacifist because I did believe there were circumstances in which military defense would be justified, but I just felt this war was abhorrent and would not participate in it, like many young men of my generation. So I faced difficult choices. What can you do? I have friends who went to jail. I had friends who became expatriates, who left the country for good. I knew other people who faked psychiatric illnesses. That's another way you could get out of the military in those days. I went to a seminary. Another way to avoid the military was to go to a seminary because people studying for the ministry were given draft deferments. So I went to a Unitarian seminary in Berkeley, California, and during that time I was an intern chaplain at San Quentin Prison. So during the time I was at the seminary, I also worked as the assistant to the Protestant chaplain at San Quentin. And that really was just an extraordinary personal experience. While I was there, I became very actively involved with a group of activists involved in prisoner rights. This was at the height of the period, this was 1970, at the height of the period of the Black Panthers. There were lots of African-American prisoners in San Quentin who were basically there for political reasons of one sort or another. So I was involved in the prisoner rights movement and used my position as assistant to the chaplain at San Quentin to gather information, to interview prisoners, and to interview guards and the warden and other people. And I wrote a book called The Politics of Punishment, which was about the nature of incarceration at that time in California in the early 70s. In 1971, the rules of the draft changed to a lottery, and the lottery number that I corresponded to my birthday was a high number, so I didn't have to worry about being drafted. And so I left the seminary at that point and went to graduate school in sociology at Berkeley. In 1976, I finished my PhD and was offered a job at Wisconsin and have been here ever since. I've had many offers and opportunities to go to other universities on the East and West Coast. I was tempted once. Berkeley offered me a professorship in the late 80s, and I went back to Berkeley to try it out, to see what it would be like for a year. And after a year, I decided that I'd rather be a professor at the University of Wisconsin than at Berkeley. The people at Berkeley thought I must be a lunatic. You know, they feel they live in paradise, and how could anybody prefer Wisconsin to Berkeley, California? But I really felt much more grounded here in a kind of healthier, freewheeling academic and intellectual open environment here than actually existed at Berkeley. And this felt like a better place for me to pursue my academic career and a better place for me to raise my children. I have, as I said, I have two daughters, grown at this point. One is in Australia for 3 years. Her husband has a postdoctoral fellowship in climate science, so she's in Sydney and hasn't quite figured out what to do with herself, but is having a good time. And my other daughter is a theater director in Philadelphia. Anybody from Philadelphia? She's a theater director. Oh, good. So she's a theater director. She has a small company called Applied Mechanics and has gotten a fair amount of recognition in recent years and is having a great time making her life in the arts. The fact that she is a theater director makes me acutely aware of the difficulties that a person has in pursuing that kind of life in a country which historically has provided almost no support for people in the arts, and in particular makes it almost impossible for them to get health insurance. It's essentially impossible for her to afford health insurance, except if the new health insurance rules remain in place, then in 2014 she'll finally be able to afford health insurance. That's a theme we'll get to later in the course. So I've been here since 1976. I love being a professor. I think it's a fantastic job. It's one of the most privileged kinds of positions one can have, in the sense of living a life where you have control over what you do, where you spend your time reading and talking and learning new and interesting things, constantly renewed by new cohorts of students. If I was independently wealthy, if I was endowed with $1 million and could live without working, there is almost nothing that I do that would be different. So in a sense, I live a life of what I would describe as complete freedom. Because although I have a job, and there are officially requirements, and I get paid, even if I was paid nothing at this job, and had a private endowment to provide me my income, there is virtually nothing that I do that I would change. Now that's extraordinary, obviously. Most people don't have that privilege to live a life where you have such total control over how you organize your time, what you do, and how you do it. I think with that level of privilege comes responsibility, too. And as I've interpreted this responsibility, it's to make both my teaching and my academic work matter. To, in whatever way I can, try to make the world a better place by the activities that I engage in. And one aspect of that is indeed this class, American Society, How It Really Works, is one expression of the commitment to trying to make the world a better place in both my teaching and my writing that I've tried to embody in my career. In this class, we are going to explore three overarching questions. Now, these are laid out in the prologue to the in the first chapter of the book, so I'll just briefly mention them here. Let me just tell you how the lectures are going to go in general. The lectures are going to fairly closely track the material in the book, rather than the lectures being on different material that complements the book. Now, I do that for a variety of reasons. I think it's often useful to hear it as well as read it. Different people learn in different ways. For some people, learning is best done by listening. For other people, learning is best done by reading. So you're getting it through two different media. Also, I think the ideas in the material is difficult enough that having a repetition by my tracking the same structure in the lectures will be helpful to many of you in the class. Okay, there are three questions that organize the overarching framework of what we'll be discussing. First is, what kind of a society is this? That's going to be the main focus of the next lecture. Societies come in all sorts of flavors, both historically and in the present world. What is the kind of society that is American society? That's actually turns out to be a pretty interesting and difficult question to really nail down. How does it really work? Now, we all have lots of ideas about how it works. One of the interesting things about teaching sociology is that everybody who lives in a society is at least an amateur sociologist. You know, there's no important question we're going to discuss in which you're not going to have lots of views about. If I were to ask you, why does the United States have a higher percentage of its children living in poverty than any other developed country? Why are we at the tail end of the distribution of child poverty? All of you would be able to give some kind of answer to that question. At least all of you who have lived in the United States. I'm sure there are some members of the class who are foreign students and therefore may not have a good feel for what the possible explanations, but everybody has an explanation for that. That's an interesting thing. It's different if you're taking a course in, you know, astrophysics. Most students, when they enter an astrophysics course, don't have their own personal views about astronomy and astrophysics. They are coming to learn what the professor has to say. Whereas you already have well-formed views about everything I'm going to have to say about how does it really work. And some of your views will be very different from mine. That's one of the things, again, that makes it an interesting effort. The act of teaching sociology, therefore, is not really just about imparting information. It's also about transforming what people already believe. The act of imparting information is also an act of transformation. How does it really work? And in what ways does it need changing? Ultimately, the reason it matters to know how a system really works is if you think the system as it works creates harms. Unless you know how it really works, it's unlikely you'll be very effective in figuring out what needs changing. The punchline, the real point of the way I do my own type of sociology is to come to terms with the problem of what needs changing and how do we change it. Those are the three overarching questions. Now, it's impossible to approach these questions without bringing various kinds of values to bear on the material. The idea that you can have a social science which is value neutral, in which the analysis takes no position on values whatsoever, that's just an illusion. All social science has within it embedded values, and I think it's important to make it explicit, not to hide them, not to pretend that values are irrelevant. And so what I want to do is share with you the values that underlie this course, and then to say something about my own stance with respect to these values. There are five core values that animate the investigations we will be doing of how American society really works. Freedom, prosperity, efficiency, fairness, and democracy. These are all values, I think, which Americans broadly hold, at least if you just use the words and don't bother defining them. Most Americans say, yeah, freedom's a good thing, prosperity, I'm for that, efficiency, better than inefficiency. Fairness is pretty good, I don't want to live in an unfair world, and democracy is better than dictatorship. So most people endorse these values. Of course, a lot hinges on precisely what you mean by these values. Let me just briefly give you the definitions of these values that I use in the book. First, freedom. And this comes straight from this prologue. The prologue to the book has these definitions, the definitions that I will be using. So you don't have to madly scribble these down. You will see them in the prologue to the book. Freedom. Freedom is the idea that people should be able to live their lives to the greatest degree possible as they wish. People should be able to live their lives to the greatest degree possible as they wish. This means people should be free from coercive restrictions imposed by others as much as possible and have the capacity to put their life plans into effect. Now, as we'll see when we discuss this more carefully, that last bit and have the capacity to put their life plans into effect. Capacity to put your life plans into effect. That is a crucial part of the idea of freedom. Freedom, as I will argue, is not merely being free from coercion, it's actually being able to do stuff. To be free from coercion and to starve is not being free. You have to have a capacity to put your life plans into effect in order to be fully free. And that makes freedom a really complicated matter. It's not a simple idea, it's a very complicated idea, if it includes this notion of capacity. Capacity to act, not just freedom from coercion. Freedom, that's how I understand freedom. Prosperity is the idea that an economy should generate a high standard of living for most people, not just for a privileged elite. Prosperity as a value doesn't mean prosperity for the few. It means prosperity for, if not everybody, at least prosperity as the general condition of life for people. Economic efficiency. This is the idea that the economy should generate rational outcomes, effectively balancing costs and benefits in the way resources are used. Now, that's also a pretty complicated idea. Efficiency, as we'll see when we discuss it, is not a simple matter. Efficiency is not the same as profitability. Efficiency means balancing costs and benefits in a rational way. And what exactly that means turns out to be tricky. Fairness. Fairness is the idea that people should be treated justly and that they should have equal opportunity to make something of their life, of their lives, without unfair privileges and unfair disadvantages. Fairness as a social value, as a value about how a society should be organized, says that people should be treated justly and that they should have equal opportunity to make something of their lives without unfair privileges. An unfair privilege is a violation of fairness, but also without unfair disadvantage. Finally, democracy is the idea that our public decisions should reflect the collective will of equal citizens rather than powerful elites. Democracy doesn't mean just having elections. It means that our collective decisions, our public decisions, the decisions which are binding on everyone, should reflect the collective will of equal citizens rather than just powerful elites. That's what the idea of democracy means. When you think of democracy as rule by the people, that's what by the people means. Equal citizens should determine the publicly binding decisions that get made. There are four kinds of disagreements that we can have around these values. First, people can disagree about what is meant by each of these values. So I gave you my definitions. I gave you, you know, very synoptic shorthand versions of definitions of these four, of these five values. Well, there could be honest disagreements about what values mean, what the values mean. And we'll be discussing some of these in the course of the semester. Does democracy simply mean majority rule, or does it actually require active involvement of equal citizens in politics? Well, that's a disagreement. Some people think that a democracy simply requires majority rule. Others feel that it requires something deeper. We'll see, especially, I think, most acutely around the notion of fairness, that there are deep disagreements as to exactly what we mean by fairness, what counts as an unfair society. Is it or is it not unfair that some children are born to great wealth and have very expensive private education and intensive tutoring in taking their SAT exams, and therefore score on average 150 points higher on SATs than do students without those advantages? Does that give them an unfair advantage in getting admitted to certain universities? Or is that just how it is? There's nothing unfair about it. Well, that's a dispute. That's something we'll have to come to terms with. That's one kind of disagreement. A second kind of disagreement is about the actual performance of our institutions with respect to these values. Now, this is what we'll be spending a lot of time exploring. When we ask, how does American society really work? One of the things we'll be doing is saying, well, how does it really work with respect to, let's say, democracy? Let's look at American democratic institutions and ask the question, how democratic are these? How well do they live up to the value of democracy when democracy is defined as I have proposed it? And there can be disagreements among people about the actual performance. Those disagreements are, to a significant extent, empirical. People will make different claims about the actual effects of our institutions. And this is why we will spend a lot of time on that kind of issue, really getting the facts straight as the basis for then debates about the nature of the institutions and how they should change. Another kind of disagreement is about the relative priority of values. Two people could hold exactly the same value of fairness that I proposed and the notion of freedom and simply say freedom is more important than fairness. So although it is unfair for a child to be, it's unfair that a child born of very wealthy parents ends up with 150 points extra on the SAT simply because of the amount of resources the parents can devote towards tutoring for the exam, that's unfair. They would say, well, it's too bad that it's unfair because freedom is more important and people should be free to spend as much money on their children as they want. So it's not that there's a disagreement about what freedom means and what fairness means. There's just a disagreement about how you put these two together. If you care about both and they conflict, what do you do? The fact of the matter is, if we have five values, they're bound to conflict at times. Fairness and freedom often conflict. And when they conflict, what do you do? Well, that's a hard question, not an easy question. And that's a source of debate. And finally, there's the question, well, how much could things really be improved if we changed our institutions? Maybe this is the best of all possible worlds that we live in, even if it has lots of flaws. That's possible, because it could be the case that any attempt at changing things will only make things worse. You know, it's possible that the cure is worse than the disease. So we could have all sorts of criticisms about how these institutions fail on these five core values. They provide prosperity for some, but not all. They limit the freedom of some people and intensify it for others. Our democracy is crippled by corporate spending and politics, et cetera, et cetera. We could have this litany of flaws in our institutions, and yet one could say at the end of the day, tough luck. It's the best we can do. Any alternative just makes things worse. That is a possible answer to the question, what can be done? The possible answer is nothing. I won't make that argument, but it's a source of disagreement around these issues. Well, where do I stand on this? What's my position with respect to these values? I think it's only fair that I put my cards on the table. I'm at the left of the American political spectrum. So from my point of view, the main problem with the Obama administration is he's way too conservative. He is what would have been called when I was growing up a Rockefeller Republican. You know, his policy positions are basically the same as Eisenhower's. From my point of view, he's way too conservative, and he certainly is not in any remote sense a socialist. He's so far from socialism that to use the term socialism to describe his policies is to empty the term socialism of any meaning. So I'm on the left of the political spectrum, which I think will dismay at least some of you. My experience in teaching this class, there's always a group of students, some who just find it
almost incomprehensible how a person could espouse left-wing political perspectives, that this seems completely off the deep end. I hope by the end of the semester you at least find it not incoherent or crazy, but that's where I'm located. Well, what does that actually mean? What does it mean to say you're on the left of the political spectrum, as opposed to that just being a label?
Let me say what it means with respect to these values. First, freedom. Compared to most countries, the United States has succeeded in giving a great deal of individual freedom to people. But real freedom is curtailed for many, perhaps most people, by the large inequalities of material conditions of life, especially by the very high levels of poverty in the United States. Poverty is an affront to freedom. It's not just an affront to fairness, because poverty undermines the capacity of people to put their life plans into place. And I think freedom as a value has meat to it if it includes this notion of capacity. Prosperity. While many Americans are affluent compared to other parts of the world, the American economy is far too oriented towards a conception of standards of living that is preoccupied with income, wealth, and material consumption rather than the overall quality of life. True prosperity gives weight to leisure and free time rather than simply income. It places value on public goods and collective consumption rather than just private consumption. And it's concerned with long-term environmental sustainability, not just present conditions. Prosperity needs to be an idea centered around quality of life, not just sheer material consumerism. Efficiency. The United States does have a highly productive and innovative economy, but it generates pervasive irrationalities and inefficiencies because it is not subjected to sufficient social regulation. We'll spend a lot of time discussing this around such things as the environment, healthcare, inadequate job training, and various other problems. The American economy is organized in such a way that it systematically produces inefficiencies as well as efficiency. Fairness. While certain oppressive forms of discrimination have been reduced in recent decades, we remain a society that is far from providing equal opportunity for its citizens. In particular, wealth and income inequality have reached such astronomical levels that there's no conceivable way that they can be regarded as fair. If fairness means people do not have unfair advantages and disadvantages. Democracy. The rules of the game for elections in the United States, especially when combined with the pervasive role of money in generating access to the political system, have profoundly undermined American democracy. We are now not among the most democratic countries on Earth. On every index of democraticness that political scientists have developed, we are ranked now somewhere in the around 25 to 30 out of the countries of the Earth. We are not among the most democratic. To push forward on these values requires transformation. And it's because of that commitment to a transformation to realize these values that my political position would be described as being on the left. I don't think, however, that this makes it in any sense un-American. The kind of perspective that I take on these values is as deeply anchored in American traditions as are the perspectives on these values that are identified with conservative political positions. I think it is deeply American, but that these values have been marginalized in the last 30 years because of the dominance of particular political forces, which we will also be discussing in the course of the semester. Okay, we are at 12:15. The sections do begin this week. So the sections, starting on Thursday afternoon, will be meeting in this first week of classes. You should go to your sections with questions.